From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Some define success by a financial measurement, some by awards and industry recognition, and some define success as work that feels like play. My guest today is as busy with his work as he's ever been, but he says he's lucky. He plays for work. It's never the same old grind at the office, and he often makes it up as he goes along. Also, throughout his career, he's been able to work with his family. Will Purcell is a special effects coordinator. He and his wife, Jehan, own a special effects company, but his family's film work history spans three generations, beginning with his grandfather as a set painter on The Wizard of Oz in 1938. After watching his dad work in special effects for years, Will Purcell started his career on a Chuck Norris film in 1984, Invasion USA. He went on to work on dozens of productions, including Scream 5, Gerald's Game, The Strangers, Cabin Fever 2, Under the Dome, Young Guns, and Max Steel. He also worked with his father on the 1990 film Home Alone, starring Macaulay Culkin. And he joins me now. Will Purcell, what a pleasure it is to welcome you to Coastline.
Rachel, thanks for having me. That's an opening to go. It's big shoes to fill, you know, when you're talking about my family and everything like that. But
yeah.
I'm really excited to share this, you know, some of my stories.
Well, we're excited to learn about what it means to be a special effects coordinator.
Sure.
But first, there is a free screening hosted by the North Carolina Filmmakers Series of Home Alone on Sunday, December 5th at the Point 14 in Wilmington at 4 p.m. After the film, Will Purcell will participate in a Q&A. So for those who have no idea what a special effects coordinator does, what are you responsible for? When is it you versus, say, CGI or a special effects makeup? What do you do?
We do anything physical in front of camera, you know, wind, rain, fire, any mechanical gags, pyrotechnics. Usually the line between special effects and visual effects is discussed prior in production meetings, where we feel that, you know, it would be safer to enhance an explosion. That way we can have, you know, actors closer or, you know, we're at a sensitive location where we can't blow out the windows. Well, then we'll do it visual effects. You know, it's become a tool. You know, so it's something that helps us out. You know, but my job is basically to work with stunts and work with the director and the director of photography on how they want to shoot it, what the director's vision is, and then with stunts we figure out how to take it all the way to the limit without jeopardizing safety, basically.
You like to blow things up.
Yeah.
You've said that to me in the past, and you mentioned blowing things up now. Do you have to be licensed for that?
Yes, you do. I've been licensed since 1985 with the ATF. I carry a North Carolina state license as well. I also have to carry my own insurance. So that's something that a lot of people, you know, don't need to do with their jobs, but, you know, with our equipment and all that. But I enjoy it. I enjoy it a lot. It's never a dull moment.
So as a licensed pyrotechnician, is that what you would call it?
Correct.
What is your favorite explosion ever that you've done on a film or TV set?
My favorite probably was, I was with my father when they were on RoboCop, and I was actually just helping out, but they blew up the gas station when RoboCop leaves the gas station. That was probably one of the biggest explosions where, I mean, it dried my eyes out. It was so hot. And we were at a safe distance. We were, you know, we were in the safe zone, and the effects guys were a little closer in that were pushing the buttons. And, you know, the rule of thumb is if you see them running, then you should already be running. You know?
So when you're doing an explosion on what sounds like a larger scale, it's right. not just a little explosion in a bucket, but, no. you know, blowing up a gas station. Do you ever need to do it more than once to get it right or get different angles, or how does that work?
No, that's usually a one-er. So there's a lot of planning that goes into it. You know, construction will help us, you know, building, you know, facade pieces if we need to, taking away a lot of the material that could be dangerous, glass and, you know, what have you. In that particular scene, we had a stunt man in the RoboCop outfit walking away from the gas station when we hit it. And I know that at when we cut and they walked in, the back of it was melted. But it was pretty hot. They used a lot of they used aviation fuel instead of gasoline on that. And it was a pretty big explosion. It did a lot of prep, though, actually loosening and cutting through the structural parts of the walls and parts of the roof so that they would come apart easier. They had even cabled pieces off so that they didn't go flying too far, you know. So there's a lot of thought process that goes into it.
Have you ever, now, we might talk to a limited degree about The Crow a little bit later.
Sure.
But not looking at Rust or The Crow or firearms accidents, has there ever been a pyrotechnic accident that where you've just really watched things go awry and gone, okay, I can learn from that?
Luckily, not on my sets. And the guys that I've worked for in the past, you know, there's always a close call, you know, but as long as everybody walks away, you're good. It's like I said, with us in stunts, we're always trying to take things right to the line, and knowing that we're going to, you know, we're going to blow something up and we're going to have people involved in it. And we always consider all the safety. But, you know, once you push a button, it's gone. You can't rewind it and take it back, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah. Is there anything different about creating an effect for a TV production versus a film production?
Not really. At least when you're doing a film, you are not under such an insane schedule where television is complete chaos. You know, I enjoy it, but there's a lot more to it because you're working on several episodes. When you're working on a feature, you're working on one script, and you concentrate on that. And yes, there'll be changes in there, but it's one story, one thing.
And so especially
it makes it a
little
easier, right?
Yeah, and in mm-hmm. your business, mm-hmm. I would imagine that being able to take your time
Yeah.
and dot the I's and cross the T's is important.
You get a little more preparation, you know. With television, it's a little harder. You really have to plan out your scheduling and make sure you have the proper people with you to mark all your safety aspects. So, yeah.
Your family history in film is impressive. Not many people can say three generations of their family have worked as film professionals, starting with your grandfather on The Wizard of Oz, painting the set. He later built miniatures. How did he get into building miniatures, and what are some of those films?
You know, quite honestly, I don't know how he actually got the interest. I know that he was friends with it wasn't visual effects back then, but an optical director, L.B. Abbott. They were friends. And I know that relationship got him into doing miniatures and so on and so forth. He had he got recognition for the 1968 production of Tora, Tora, Tora. He built all of those miniatures, and they exist today. I believe they're in the St. Augustine Naval Museum. So it's glad to see that his work is, you know, still out there. Somebody still maintains it and takes care of it. But, you know, in the 60s and 70s, that's what they did. You know, they used, you know, miniatures with back screen projection. And we still use some of that today, but not, you know, and we still use
really?
Miniatures today. Yeah. Not as much as we leaned on them back then. But he did a Poseidon Adventure, which was amazing. I have I have pictures where he actually took pictures of the Queen Mary, and then he took a red crayon pencil and he drew the Poseidon over it, what the production designer wanted the Poseidon to look like. And so he used the Queen Mary as a reference, and he sat in a parking lot drawing pictures, and he took them back, and then they eventually did blueprints. So, yeah, he's a pretty creative guy.
Did your own father also build miniatures?
He did. He started out working in miniatures with my father after he had gotten out of Vietnam. He married my mother and literally went to Vietnam. I happened, and then he got into the business. So, yeah. And he did work in miniatures for quite a while. And early 70s, he kind of leaned more to doing special effects and started doing that, the more physical effects. And, you know, being in Vietnam, he had a lot of ordnance practice. So I think it came naturally to him.
Is that what he actually dealt with in Vietnam?
Yeah, he did. A lot of EOD stuff, and for a while he was a helicopter machine gunner. So he actually chose to go back to doing EOD because being a helicopter machine gunner was a pretty hot job. You know, you're literally flying into a hot zone and pulling your guys out and covering for them. Yeah, standing at the door with no cover, basically. So, yeah.
What are some of the miniatures that you remember from your dad's work that you might have known about growing up as a kid? Like, other kids are watching this film and going, whoa,
right.
The Towering Inferno. And you're like, I saw that. It's a little 6-inch.
Yeah. Funny enough, I actually have one, or I had one as a kid. There was a movie called excuse me.
That's okay. We can think about it during the break and come back to that. Film special effects coordinator Will Purcell is my guest today. You're listening to Coastline. After this short break, we're going to find out about that film. We're also going to go behind the scenes on the set of Home Alone. And we'll hear some about his experience on the set of The Crow. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Stay with us. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. When you watch a film and see it rain or snow, or you see an actor shot, a bullet hole appears and blood seeps out, the special effects coordinator is responsible. Will Purcell has worked on film sets creating these effects since the 1980s, some of those years working with his father, Bill Purcell, including on the 1990 Christmas movie Home Alone. Now, just before we went to break, Will Purcell, you were telling us about some miniatures that you remember as a kid.
Yeah. I had received a gift from my grandfather. There was a film in the mid-60s called The Fantastic Voyage, which was a spaceship that they had shrunk down and shot into the President of the United States. I played with that miniature as a kid. And, you know, being a kid, you know, you painted flames on it and you did all this stuff. I had a collector call me. This was probably about 15 years ago, and asked me where the Proteus was. He had done some research, and I told him I gave it to a neighbor kid, and I think he's a preacher in South Carolina. And I could just hear, you know, the phone drop on the other end. you know, but I played with him as kids. You know, I didn't really grasp the concept of, you know, how valuable they were. You know,
yeah. So your dad went on to do other kinds of special effects,
yes,
including making things blow up. And at one point, when you were ready to, you were working in the film business already. Mm-hmm. Your dad gave you a call and said, pack your bags, kid. Need you to come to Chicago to work with
Correct.
Me on a film there.
Correct.
Tell us that story.
It was kind of funny because I didn't have a lot of information. Usually when he called, you jump. and so I didn't ask a lot of questions. I asked about a script, and he says, well, you can look at it when you get here. Just get your stuff together. He says, it's called Home Alone. My first thought was, it's a slasher movie. This is going to be great. Once we got there, obviously, I was disappointed. I was like, wow, it's a Christmas movie. And I was like, oh, boy. So there was a little bit of a letdown there because a great title, Home Alone, sounds just like a serial
It does sound
movie.
Like a slasher Doesn't movie it? Now you that know? You say yeah. that. Yeah.
Right, right. But we had set up in the suburbs of Chicago in an abandoned school that they had used for other films. So every department basically had a gym or a classroom or something. We had the theater department, which was great for us because they had a loading door in the back. And so that's where we set up shop. And I started working in the rubber room, making some rubber props that we were going to be needed for some of the scenes that were going to be in the movie.
What kinds of rubber props in that film would you be making?
We made a pair of slippers for Daniel Stern. We actually used my feet because we were the same size. So it was actually a size bigger. And that way he could walk around in the snow. Simple stuff because a lot of times you see in the movie he's walking around barefoot in the snow. And most of the snow in the foreground was crushed ice, so it was cold. Also, when you see him stepping into the window and stepping on Christmas ornaments and stuff like that, you know, that was a...
So he's wearing prosthetic feet that
yes.
are rubber slippers.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah. I made the paint cans that swung down and hit him in the head. My boss had made the rubber appliance that went on Joe Pesci's head when he got torched. The lawn jockey out in the front of the yard that kept getting bumped into. That was one of my first jobs when I got there.
The lawn jockey was rubber.
Right. Yeah. They didn't want to mess up the car. And a lot of the ice that you saw on the stairs on some of the exterior scenes was actually gelatin. Back then, we weren't using silicone, and that technology hadn't come along like it has today. So we were cooking up huge batches of gelatin, inch and a half to 2 inches thick. And that was the padding for the stunt guys, you know, other than the paddings that they had underneath their clothes when they took those dives.
So you're talking, there are scenes when Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern are separately trying to get in separate doors.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Pesci's trying to go upstairs at the front.
Correct.
Daniel Stern's trying to go downstairs to get in through the back door. They're slipping on the ice, falling down all the time.
Yes.
So they couldn't just slip on regular ice. You had to make it cushy.
To take a little shock out of it, yeah. And back in those days, they didn't pad up. And those guys, they called selling out. They went for it. They hit the ground. I remember Troy, who was doubling Joe Pesci when we first did the door, when he burns his hand on the door and he slips off the front stairs, when he hit the ground so hard, everybody just went breathless and stopped. And then, of course, when they said, cut, we're all running in. He jumps up and goes, hey, great, you want another one? And, of course, we were terrified that, you know, he broke his back or something. But, you know, those guys know what they're doing. And a lot of stunt guys today, you know, they call it the Home Alone. If you're going to do a fall like that where you're not padded and you don't see any pads, it's called doing the Home Alone. Those guys kind of set a precedent. So, yeah.
Wow. And there was a point when you thought you lost your job.
Yeah. It was basically when we got there. We were setting up shop, and we had our production manager come around and say, don't unpack too much stuff. We are going to – Warner Brothers doesn't want to give us the money to, you know, complete the film. They were scheduled for $10 million, and I think they were at – I don't remember off the top of my head – something like 12 or 13. And they just didn't want to give them the money to finish the movie. Meanwhile, which we didn't know, is there was another producer making a deal with Joe Roth from Fox. He showed him the script. He said, oh, it's great. I'll give you the extra few million dollars. So by the end of the day, we were packing our bags and the next day we were unpacking them again and told that we were picked up by Fox. So yeah, it was kind of a scary moment there. You know, I was like, wow, I just got here, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah. And a good move on Fox's part.
Yeah, I'm sure Warner Brothers regrets that now.
Yeah,
as much money as Home Alone has made, you know, we didn't think it was going to do as well as it did. When you read the script, we're like, oh, okay, yes, kid runs around and, you know, he's, you know, playing Scooby-Doo with these, you know, bad guys. But once we started filming and saw the chemistry – with Joe Pesci and the kid And with Daniel Stern, it was magic. I had actually worked with both Daniel Stern and Joe Pesci just prior to working on Home Alone. So I remember the first time Joe Pesci walked into the rubber room, we had to fit him for the headpiece, and he looked at me and he goes, "You, you're that guy. I remember you." And I was like, "Oh, man." You know, he said, "Are you following me?" So, yeah, but it was good because they both knew me. So at least I had a rapport going in there when we were working with them. They're great guys.
Okay. So I do want to ask you about Macaulay Culkin's, Kevin's, battle plan, which he executes in the last 15 or 20 minutes of this film.
Right.
It's just really incredible. But first, since you've mentioned it now a couple of times, the headpiece that Joe Pesci wore when he gets blowtorched almost in the face, like at the top of his head.
Right.
How does that work? How does he not – How do his eyeballs not get singed in that scene?
They actually did it old school. They did it with mirrors, and optically they had a fake head, and they had a couple of mirrors that the camera would shoot into, and then we had Joe Pesci standing in position in one of them. And once you line them all up with the dummy head, Joe Pesci's head, and we had the torch mounted on a stand, you know, shooting into these mirrors, it gave the effect that it was actually blowing right on his head. And so he was just able to act. One of the first attempts that they did prior to that, one of the makeup people put AB smoke, which is a chemical compound. There's an A and a B, and once you touch the B to the A, it smokes. And they put that on the appliance, and it got a little hot on Mr. Pesci's head. And, yeah, he let them know, and that crew member was fired the next day.
Okay. Yeah. So he will speak up.
Yeah. He didn't have a problem speaking up. I think he had more of a problem of watching his language. He was so used to, you know, the character that we know, and, you know, we're working on a children's movie. So, you know, we would get the rated R version in rehearsal, and then we would get the rated G version when we rolled cameras. It's pretty interesting.
So Kevin, this 8-year-old, I mean, the plot for those who are new to the planet, he gets left behind as his family, aunts and uncles and cousins and immediate family, go on a Christmas trip to France. He gets left behind for various reasons in all the chaos. So he's home alone. And these two burglars, Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern, come along and they want to break into this big, beautiful home because they know the family is away. This 8-year-old is terrified. He also needs to go shopping for food. And, you know, it's a comedic survival movie for this kid. But at the very end, he says, "That's it. I have my," he draws up a battle plan. He's going to take these guys out and protect the home front. The elements in that battle plan are so creative.
It was amazing. It was a lot of fun to do that stuff, too.
So is that all figured out and written into the script? Or do you say, "Hey, we could do a scene where this happens"?
Right. There was some stuff that was in the script that, you know, we modified to make it kind of work for the stunt people and the actors themselves. But most of it was written out there in the script, and we just had to figure out how to make it work. I think the most complicated thing was torching Joe Pesci's head. A lot of the other stuff was, you know, was basic stuff, basic rigging, when paint cans are hitting the guys in the head. Of course, it hit the stunt guys in the head. And we did one, you know, close-up scene where you see the actor's face, and then they cut away to our stunt doubles. But, it was, you know, most of it was scripted, and we just had to come up with the plan to, you know, do it safely.
You're listening to Coastline. Will Purcell is my guest today. He is a film special effects coordinator and has worked on The Hunger Games, Idlewild, The List, Gerald's Game, Max Steel, Outer Banks Season 1, among many others. And he worked with his father on the 1990 film Home Alone. The North Carolina Filmmaker Series is offering a free screening of Home Alone on Sunday, December 5th. At the Point 14 in Wilmington at 4 p.m. after the film, Will Purcell will participate in a live Q&A. Going back to Home Alone, there is a scene when this 8-year-old kid engineers some mannequins. He causes them to dance and seemingly move around the living room. So from the outside, through the curtains, it looks as if there's a party going on.
Right.
How did you create these dancing mannequins?
But a lot of it was done what we call D&D or down and dirty. It had to look like a kid did a lot of the stuff. So a lot of it was popsicle sticks and shoestrings, you know, the cardboard Michael Jordan. And you know, we had to figure out how to for it to balance itself on a toy train, which went around in circles. And exactly, you know, making the mannequins give a little bit of motion, but also, you know, making it look like an 8-year-old kid did it.
Was that something that you had to consider throughout the film? Like, this can't be too good, because if it is, nobody's going to buy that a little kid put it together.
Or if it is, make sure you cover it up real well, you know.
Did you call yourself a snow bunny?
When we were talking,
Yes. So there's snow everywhere in this film. It's Chicago. The snow outside. Not talking about Christmas Day when snow is actually coming down, but just the snow itself. Was that real snow?
No. We had a lucky break where we had a good snow blurry, and the production told us, we're changing our schedule. Stop what you're doing. We're going to the house. So, of course, everybody made a mad scramble to the house, dressed what we needed to because we had the real snow. And we've got more snow than we anticipated, which is great. But then as we filmed, we had to keep it up. But we were able to get those scenes. Oddly enough, it was a year where we didn't get a lot of snow in Chicago that year. And they were really worried about it. You know, we had the first day we'd used potato flakes, which we don't use anymore. But back in those days, we would use potato flakes. And it looks fantastic. After about 3 days, it doesn't smell so great. So the neighborhood wasn't real happy about that. But we used a lot of foam, which was based off of aviation foam. You see, when planes crash, they put out this foam. Well, we use a similar product, just without all the firefighting chemicals into it. And snow batting, which is quilt material. We would unroll it in the backs, in the foreground or the background, and pin it down so everything looked white. That snow only lasted, you know, for a couple of days, and then it was gone, and we had to recreate everything. So as being a snow bunny, it was, you know, there were two 48-foot reefer trucks that we had parked off down the street, and we were literally carrying bags of crushed ice and dressing it in the foreground. Yeah. And dressing foam in the back. And so, yeah, we had an army of snow bunnies doing that.
One of the things that has evolved, I guess, over the course of years in special effects is when you are creating things like snow from your own materials, you have to find out about all of the allergies of the people who are going to be on the set, the actors, the crew.
Yeah, everything, especially if you're doing dust. You know, there's so many people with peanut allergies out there. And one of the materials we used to use, we don't use it very much anymore, was walnut dust. We have to do, ask these questions in production and provide safety data sheets for everything we do, from the snow liquid to the haze, which we create fog effects with, to the goo that we turn into mud, or, you know, like slime stuff. All of that stuff we have to have all the safety data sheets and make it available to the crew. A big one now is atmosphere or haze, you know, with COVID and everything else. They've really locked down on what materials we can use, some we can't anymore. So it's narrowed that choice as far as what kind of machines and what kind of fluids we use. So luckily a lot of them are glycol based, and bacteria can't survive in it. So that's a plus for us with COVID. Yeah.
So much of your business has to do with creating these effects and doing it in a safe way. How much do you have to deal with firearms? What element of gunfights do you deal with?
We only deal with the after effect. You know, somebody will fire a gun and you'll see a hole in the wall, or, you know, the glass breaks. There are some effects technicians that do both. I'm one that chose not to. I carry enough responsibility having to carry explosive license and everything else. Usually a prop person or a weapons master will come on the set and handle the weapons themselves, you know, and there's a protocol that we go through to, we're supposed to go through, that to ensure safety for everybody. And obviously, with the recent accident with Rust, and I experienced I was on the Crow, so I experienced some of that. A lot of those simple rules just weren't followed. It was negligence, basically, on both cases, in my opinion. It's funny now with the Rust situation. You don't hear about it as much in the media now. It's kind of starting to quiet up a little bit, and it's going to take a while for them to get down to who's going to sue who and who's liable. It's basically the production company that's liable, and the person that's handling the weapons, which they were irresponsible.
Yeah, and is it true that people were actually taking these weapons, talking about the Rust set now, on the weekends when they weren't shooting?
Yes.
And playing with them and using live rounds?
Yeah, they were shooting in at the range with the guns that they were using on the set. They did that on the Crow, too. We had more modern guns on the Crow. We had a lot of Tommy guns and AK-47s and all that. And we did the guys did go out on the weekends and do that. Our weapons master on the show was very safety conscious, and there was never a live round on the set, and he knew to check everything. And with all of those gunfights on that movie and all of those scenes where bullet hits, we never had any incidents or any accidents. They laid him off because there was only one working gun left on the show, and our prop master had an FFL license, so they let Sam go. Sam was actually a local guy here, Sam Allen. I don't think he's with us anymore. He used to own Allen Hydraulics. But, they would do that. They would take him out and shoot him, which is a no-no.
We're going to hear more about that. You're listening to Coastline. Special effects coordinator Will Purcell is my guest today. We'll also hear, after this short break, how he's able to keep going in some of the more challenging moments. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're exploring the world of filmmaking through the eyes of the special effects coordinator. Will Purcell started his career in 1984 on a Chuck Norris movie called Invasion USA. He went on to work on Home Alone, Scream 5, The Strangers, Young Guns, The Hunger Games, Gerald's Game, among many, many others. Just before we went to break, we had started to talk about The Crow, right, and what went wrong in terms of firearms on the set. And you say there was negligence on both the set of Rust, the recent shooting done by Alec Baldwin, and negligence on The Crow. And you talked about crew members on both sets,
right,
having taken firearms and used them on the weekends when they're not shooting the film, to have some fun with live rounds.
Correct. That's taboo, number one. The number one rule is you just don't have live ammunition on the set, period.
Right.
And
so what was wrong then on The Crow with the crew not bringing live ammunition onto the set, but having it recreationally somewhere else?
They were taking a lot of the guns and shooting them on the weekend on The Crow. The one thing that I can say that they didn't do is have live ammunition on the set. I know the weapons master, who's no longer with us, and he knew that rule and he lived by it. They actually let him go about a week before the incident happened. They only had one working gun left on the movie, and we had hundreds of machine guns and crazy stuff, and we had never had an incident. And it was down to the last couple of weeks of filming. And what happened on The Crow is different than what happened on Rust. On Rust, they actually had a live round that was shot and was on the set. on the Crow, they were actually making dummy rounds, which means they were pulling the bullets apart, dumping the black powder out of there, popping the primers on the back, and then super gluing them back together and putting them in the gun so that when you looked in the revolver, you could see the bullets.
Is that the same thing as a blank?
No. This is making a dummy bullet. A blank has black powder in it, and it's going to fire, and it's going to have that same powder release without a projectile. So it's a bullet minus the lead, basically. The dummy round was strictly for looks. Unfortunately, what happened, and to this day nobody knows who, when they were assembling the dummy bullets, they didn't pop the primer on the back. And at some point, when that gun had those bullets in there, somebody, whether it was the extra or the actor, had pulled the trigger, and because it was just a primer, it made a little pop sound, and it was enough to dislodge that super glued lead into the barrel of the gun. Several days later, we go to use the gun. We set up the scene. I had actually set up the shirt on Brandon Lee that was supposed to, that had the bullet hits on it, and I was told to go to the day shift because we were needing to prep. And
this was a pretty intense project. This shirt. How many squibs did it have on it?
We only had a couple on that particular shirt. There were times when Brandon jumped on the table where we had like 75 hits on him. His wardrobe weighed like 50 pounds. You know, it was like walking around in an iron suit. Back then, we used brass as our backing. We use titanium now, so it's a lot lighter and doesn't sag as much. But we were using what we had back in the day. But what had happened on the set, and like I said, I had left. I had rigged my shirts, and I was told to go home and turn around. So I'm at home, and obviously the inexperienced prop person who had just gotten their new FFL loaded full load blanks into that gun without checking it. And of course, now we know now that there was an actual lead that had pushed out and lodged itself in the barrel, and they didn't check the gun.
You didn't know that right away, though.
They did not.
You had gone home.
I was gone, right.
When Brandon Lee was shot, and then you got a call.
I did. I got a call. It was about roughly 6 in the morning that says, hey, just want to let you know there's been an accident on the set. Your squib may have hurt Brandon, which immediately I was, terrified. The second call I got an hour later was he was dead. And so I was living with this, oh, my gosh, did I hurt somebody? There was a couple other crew members involved.
You thought you might have actually killed him yourself.
I thought that squib had done something. I called my father immediately on the phone and went through the steps with him. And, he assured me. He says, Will, even if they taped that thing on backwards and taped it right to its squib, he said, man, it would hurt, but it wouldn't do that. It wouldn't kill him. 36 hours went by, and then I got a phone call letting me know that it was a projectile. There was a piece of lead in him, so it wasn't the squib because that's an independent piece, compared to the gun. That's when we knew that they had taken full load blanks and handed it to the actor basically without checking the barrel. And when the actor pulled the trigger, it was a full load blank, so that's the same powder as a regular bullet. And it was enough to push that lead through the barrel of the gun and go into Brandon. And it was terrifying when he hit the ground. My buddy told me that he joked around a lot, and they said cut, and he was kind of and we thought, oh yeah, he's messing around, and he wasn't, and they had to get the medics and the emergency vehicles over there and bring him to the hospital immediately, and everybody was in shock. So,
this had a profound effect on you, even after you found out that you weren't responsible for it.
Yeah, I was terrified. It took me a while to have the confidence to push a button again, knowing that, this stuff is serious, and, you can't take shortcuts. And we have a lot of we have protocols that are in line. They've been in line, and like I said, on shows like Rust, they didn't abide by the number one taboo rule, which is no live ammunition on set. The Crow was an unfortunate accident, it broke my heart. Brandon was a great guy. He knew all crew members. He would make sure that he knew your name, even if he had to ask you a couple times. His fiance was on his way there. His mom was on her way to Screen Gem Studios. It was really, really difficult. It broke my heart.
How do you think that it's changed the way you think about what you do now because of that?
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest things now is that they will ask, does anybody want to inspect the gun, you know, before they hand it off to the actors. Of course, I'm usually one of the first ones that wants to go up there and look at it. They run a zip tie through the gun when they can, but they're always it shows that there's no obstruction in there, so on and so forth. Things are, you know, when you bring a gun on the set, it's serious. There are some guns that are plugged and adapted so that you can't shoot lead out of them, and they do use a lot of those. With some of these Western guns, they don't. Those guns on Rust were period guns. So, you know, they didn't have a lot of those plugs. I understand that a lot of the extras were bringing their own guns on the set, which is another one that's kind of like a what moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this shooting on The Crow changed things in Wilmington. There was there are now some film safety guidelines here because of this.
Yeah.
How did those come about?
After the incident, our fire department, I believe it was Chief Blackley, and I forget the other officer, forgive me, but they went out to Los Angeles. They went and met with the Los Angeles fire marshal, and they observed the protocols and that they do in Hollywood and the things that they're supposed to do, and they basically came up with a Wilmington filming guideline, which I thought was pretty impressive. You know, they went out and made sure that, you know, things are going to be done by the rules here, and we still go by them today. But, you know, they made an effort to learn, you know.
Things will change again.
Oh, yeah.
After this Rust incident, mm-hmm. or tragedy, I guess. You're not so sure that they're going to change for the better?
It's about following the rules, you know, and if you follow the rules and you don't let production push you, that's another problem. They're on a time limit, they're on a budget limit, and they want you to get it done. And, you know, they'll bully you sometimes, they'll push you. You can't let them do that, you know, especially when it comes to safety. There's always somebody out there that's going to cut a corner, you know, or not follow the rules or think that that's okay. You can't babysit everybody, but, you know, all I can say is anybody that's, you know, that's in a position, they should, you know, they should really follow and up to date themselves on the rules, on the guidelines, you know, and there should never be any guns that can shoot live rounds on the set, period.
So when you're in a situation where there's time pressure, because time is money, mm-hmm. on a set of any kind,
right?
And I guess there are just varying degrees of pressure. And somebody says, all right, does anybody want to inspect the gun? When you step up and say, yeah, I want to look at it, is there sort of a like, oh, God, here we go. Now it's going to take 15 minutes for this guy to do this thing. Like, does that happen? Do you care?
To be honest with you, it doesn't happen with any of our local AD staff. Because they've all been through that and they know what goes on. A lot of the AD staff out of town that come in, you know, that haven't experienced that or have no clue that the incident of The Crow even happened on the sound stage that they're shooting on. Sometimes they'll give you pressure, you know, or give you the eyeball. And, you know, the fact of the matter, it doesn't matter. I want to look. I want to check. You know,
that's the bottom
line. No. And it's the same with doing explosives. They keep telling you, asking you how long, got to hurry up. You know, I'm doing explosives on the set. So, you know, I'm not going to hurry up. I always have a rule that if they keep asking me, I add 10 minutes to the time. So that kind of restricts them. So usually they'll only ask once.
Do you think that this Rust incident is going to change things so much that you won't? I mean, you talk about following the rules. And if people just followed the rules and didn't cut any corners, things like this wouldn't happen. So it sounds like you're saying the rules don't need to change, but they will. And do you think that special effects will lose something?
I don't think effects will really lose something. There'll be more restrictions on weapons on the set and how they're used, what, you know, and what kind of weapons. And, you know, if they need to spend the money to get the proper weapons that, you know, are either plugged or shoot a non-gun charge, then they need to do so. You know, I just think that, you know, anything like this will always have blowback. And, you know, so I'm sure there'll be some regulations that'll tighten up and, you know, they'll add more rules to it, which is fine. You know, the fact of the matter is they were already in place. So, you know, they just need to step up and follow it. There wouldn't have been an incident like that, you know. So
other things are changing in the industry as well, particularly technology. It's getting cheaper, lighter, easier. What do you think that's doing to the art of filmmaking?
It's a tool. It's a tool. It's made things a lot easier than, you know, let's say 20 years ago when we were, you had to stop and you had to change a canister of film and, you know, you watch dailies the day after when they had the film developed and flown back, and then you got to watch dailies. Now we get to see it right there and live in the cameras. Everything's digital now. It makes it a lot easier. They can take more. They can do more takes. You know, in that aspect, it's great for the industry. You know, they have a lot more options to the table. They can color correct things, and they don't. You know, film is a fickle character. Film is a beautiful thing, but you know, it's made it a lot easier with the digital technology. As far as my part of the industry, there's always new, you know, machines or gadgets that come out. It's great. It helps us out. You know, there's some of them are probably unnecessary and kind of ridiculous, but, you know, there's always something out there, you know, and I think it goes with a lot of the departments. Some of them are exactly the same. I mean, when you're in your lighting, I mean, there's lighter lights now and they're not as bulky and heavy. And so that helps them out, but, you know, you're still lighting. But as far as in general, I think that it's just going to help out.
When you think about your career so far, you've accomplished so much. You have so many productions under your belt. You're the guy. But is there anything that you haven't created that you still want to be able to do? Like you told me recently you had to figure out how to make a whole building shake.
Right.
And then you had to make it snow inside the building. What have you not yet done that you're thinking, yeah, well, that's on my bucket list?
You know, I've worked on many projects and I've done just about anything they can come up with, you know. But there's some creative writer out there that's going to write some gag into their script, and hopefully it's challenging, and we'll have to sit there and figure it out. You know, it's because there's already been so much done. You know, it's there's not much that hasn't been done. Let's just put it that way. You know, but like I said, there's always somebody's going to figure something out that we, you know, it's going to be a challenge to us, and I look forward to it. I know most effects guys are like that.
Do you ever see yourself retiring, or is this something that you're going to do until?
Yeah, yesterday. No, you know, it gets crazy. It gets a little more insane when you take on more responsibility, but I still have fun going to work and doing what I do. I know that someday I'll have to retire, but I don't think about it. I think I'll be doing this until I physically can't do it anymore. It's always a challenge. It's fun. You work the camaraderie of a film crew, especially Wilmington film crew. You know, these are your friends. These guys have got your back, and you know, and at the end of the day, the bottom line is we're still having fun, even if we've been doing it for 25 or 30 years. You know, we're still having fun doing it.
Yeah. And that's this edition of Coastline. Will Purcell, what a pleasure having you with us today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
Thanks also to the North Carolina Filmmaker Series. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Jonathan Furnell engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, find it at whqr.org or just subscribe to the podcast. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.